Welcome to the latest episode of Your Wealth with Gemma Dell, a podcast series designed to help you create, grow, and protect your wealth.
Hi, and welcome to Your Wealth. I'm Gemma Dale, NAB Trade's Director of SMSF and Investor Behaviour. Today I'm interviewing Jack Lowenstein from Morphic Asset Management about his views on the state of the market, the things he's most worried about, and where he sees the greatest opportunities for investors at the current time. Jack's been managing ethical funds for nearly two decades now, originally with Hunter Hall and now with Morphic Asset Management, which he co-founded in 2012. Jack, thanks for joining me.
Great to be here.
I'm going to talk a little bit about how you manage money, and you can feel free to jump in any time. I think it's really interesting and important to point out to our investors that the way you manage money is a bit different to the average fund manager, and it's very, very different to the way our investors currently manage their portfolios. So your funds are global. You invest exclusively offshore?
Well, we can invest in Australia, but only as part of the world.
Right, okay.
So we do from time to time invest in Australia. I guess the other thing's a little bit different. We are ethically screened. Everything we do operates under an ethical screen.
Yes.
Second point is we're a long-short manager, so we can short stocks as well as go long them. And we often do short Australian stocks because they're actually very easy to short.
Right.
From our point of view. And the third point is we have a very tight focus on risk management. Our view is that our clients want us to keep up with the markets when markets are going well, and they expect us to outperform a bit when the markets go down. Over time, that'll mean they get a better outcome with a lower risk.
Okay, lovely. So that point you make about long short's really important. The ethical screens are really important. We're going to talk about that a little bit later, but you apply both a negative and a positive screen, which is a little bit unusual.
Yes, so the negative screen means we can't invest in what we call generically sin stocks, alcohol, tobacco, and gambling. And we also don't invest in stocks where there's the business are involved in environmental destruction, including oil and gas.
Right.
On the positive screen side, we have to have at least 5% of the two funds we run invest in companies which we think are working to make the world a better place.
Right.
So that's things like working on improving water quality, air quality, or it could be things like education, or making financing available to people who can't get it, for example,
in developing countries, for example.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay, great. So if I think about it, there's a couple of other things. Also, you have a dynamic cash weighting, which not all fund managers do. Our direct investors definitely have a dynamic cash weighting, but not all fund managers do. And you also hedge currency risks if you feel that's appropriate.
Correct.
So that's quite a wide range of tools that you will use. And also when we look at your sector focus and your allocation to different countries and geographies, you're not going with the larger, more traditional areas so much.
And the other thing is that's quite correct. Also, we tend to invest in what we call small and medium stocks. That's not super small, by the way. US 400 million and above.
Right.
But we're also because we have this tight focus on risk management, we tend to invest in more liquid companies, even if they're relatively small, because we want to make sure that if we've made a mistake, we can exit quickly.
We can get out. Okay, beautiful. So I just wanted to point that out because it is a much wider toolkit than many fund managers employ, and it's a much wider toolkit than most individuals employ. Most individuals don't short, for example. They are usually long currency, that sort of thing. So it's interesting how you can look at a much more diverse range of tools to get an outcome.
Well, let me put it this way. I think a lot of SMSF investors do a really good job investing in Australian equities. We're trying to do stuff that we don't think SMS investors should do at home on their own, if you put it very simply. And you know, global equities is one additional level of complexity.
Yes.
Having an ethical screen is another additional level of complexity. Yeah. And having a long, short strategy to manage risk is a further addition to so if you look at where we are, we're definitely trying to do something that an can't do at home. And so I'm giving you a classic example. I don't invest in direct equities myself.
Right.
I only invest in our own funds. Because frankly, I'm going to do a better job in doing that within the context of our own funds.
Yeah. Okay. Fantastic. That's really helpful. So I think it's really important for investors to understand that it is different It's a different approach entirely to what they're familiar with. And it's also, I'm assuming, benchmark unaware, given some of the things you've talked about, or relatively low awareness of the benchmarks.
Look, that is correct. I mean, you know, we do think it's our job to outperform. Certainly after fees, we should be before fees, we should be outperforming. After fees, we should be outperforming as well. The other part, we have two funds. We've got the Morphic Global Opportunities Fund, which is a daily liquidity, $10,000 minimum subscription unit trust. And we have the Morphic Ethical Equities Fund, which is a listed investment company, which is currently trading at a small discount on the stock market. So for your clients who like listed companies, the MEC is probably the one. And for those who like unit trusts, the MGOF is for them.
Beautiful. Okay, thank you so much. So let's talk about your feelings about markets right now. You can obviously take a variety of different positions depending on where you feel markets are. Your top 10 positions, your top 10 active positions, are all long at the moment. So what does that tell us about what you're thinking?
Look, I think we are, broadly speaking, fairly positive about the outlook. We're in an environment where global growth is still trending upwards. We've had a bit of a shot in the arm from the Trump tax cuts.
Yes, quite the shot.
Europe is still a bit of a worry.
What concerns you about Europe?
Well, I mean, you know, the fact is that the forward indicators, the sentiment indicators, have turned a bit negative. But they've probably turned so negative now that they're almost bound to recover a bit.
Okay.
And there's still a question about monetary policy in Europe. In the US, the markets have come to accept that interest rates are going to go up because the economy can stand it, and the Federal Reserve wants to have to take some of the punch out of the party before it gets out of hand.
Yes.
In Europe, it's not as clear to me that a tightening of monetary policy can be done without stalling the economic recovery there, which is a bit tentative. And parts of Europe are just not doing that well because there's a fundamental problem with the euro, which isn't going to go away.
Yeah.
Basically, the euro is, you know, is cheap enough or even too cheap for Germany against the US dollar, but it's too strong against the US dollar for Spain, Italy, and France.
Yeah, some of the more
and that's
fragile
a
economies.
Real challenge.
Yeah. Okay. So you're still, though, largely positive.
Yes.
And what are you positive about?
Look, at the moment we have an overweight towards Japanese stocks, and it's been a slightly choppy couple of days. But we believe that the fundamentally there's a great opportunity there in the real estate sector, where unlike the rest of the world, Japan had its bust in about 1990, and real estate prices in Japan. I'm talking about apartments and houses are still way below where they were in 1990.
It's quite extraordinary for Australian investors to get their heads around the idea that a property market would have been depressed for nearly three decades.
Well, I mean, as an owner of a house myself, I'm not very excited about saying this, but the reality is, you know, when things have gone up as much as they have for so long, we're probably all, you know, sitting on assets that may have some downside in them, which is one of the reasons why I personally have so much more equities in global equities, because, you know, I need that counterweight
for balance.
The fact that Australia has probably had it. You know, it's been great. The economy has been well managed here by and large for a long time, but eventually things do run out of steam.
Yes.
And, you know, Australia is very proud of the fact that we haven't had a recession since 1991.
Yes.
But the reality is that can't go on forever.
No, that's very true.
And if you look at Japan, Japan's a bit of the reverse of that. And indeed.
Very much so, yeah.
And so another theme we've got in the portfolio is we're a bit overweight, we're quite overweight in US regional banks and US banking generally. And it's much the same story. You know, I know that a lot of Australian investors tend to be quite overweight Australian banks.
Yeah.
So the question would naturally arise, you know, are we just giving them the same risk as they already have?
Yeah. Or perhaps more. With some currency in there as well.
Exactly. But our view is it's quite a different market. So, you know, Australia's got four big banks and one or two small banks, but basically it's very oligopolistic. There's no change in market share. It's not very dynamic from the point of view of investing in those entities. You get long-term trends where one bank does the other better than the other bank for a long time, but it's glacial, you know, in terms of that change. You wake up 20 years later and things have changed, but, you know, didn't. America, where we have quite a large overweight in regional banks, is a much more dynamic market.
Yes.
There are many regional banks. Many of them have very, very, they vary enormously in terms of their management quality, in terms of their strategy, and in terms of their execution. So we do, we look very hard at that as a sector, because we're a long short manager.
Yes.
We like to be able to go find industries where there are very good companies and not so good companies.
Yes.
Then we can make a call that we'll buy the one that we think is good and underpriced, and sell the one that is cheap and overpriced, or just sell. There's actually an ETF which we can sell, which gives us the, you know, the offset leg.
Lovely.
So we've got some very obscure names in that sub portfolio.
your portfolio is interesting. Certainly for investors who like to look at what professionals are doing, it's really exciting to see a portfolio where I literally have no idea of any of the names in there. That's quite exciting for a lot of our investors.
I mean, and some of the names are, so one of our large positions is a company called Bank of Internet, which is hard to believe, but it is a thing. It was a bank. It's a branchless bank, so it's very much the kind of bank of the future.
Yes.
And it was launched during the internet, the great internet bubble of the late 99-2000. And it's now a very fast growing, very well managed company, very high returns. And it's, you know, it's still, but having said that, it's still only about $10 billion of assets.
Right.
So it can grow enormously without really, you know, nobody's going to notice its growth because it's not stealing very much from anybody else.
Yes.
So that's Bank of Internet. We also own a company called, which is based in San Diego. It operates all over America. We own a company called Eagle Bank, which is incredibly tightly focused by comparison. They're the leading regional bank based in Washington, D.C. and the area around. One of the richest areas in America in Washington, D.C., Maryland, and Virginia, incredibly well managed, very high tight focus on asset quality, but with a niche of only investing in basically lending to real estate developers and both commercial and homes, in one of the fastest growing segments of America, and then lastly we have a company called in this sub portfolio called Western Alliance, based in Phoenix, Arizona, which has got, it's geographically constrained by being operating only in the sort of western areas of America, basically Arizona, Nevada, California, those are its three main states. And it lends, it's a bit more, it does have a broader risk appetite, but it has specialist niches and things like lending to people who want to set up motels, where there's a lot of very explicit domain experience, or people setting up chains of dentistry parlors. These are the kind of things it does.
Wow.
So, you know, it's very focused. It's got a lot of domain experience, both in the geographies it works in and in the niches it lends to. And we like to invest in these in companies where they've already had a long track record of success, as each of these has.
Okay. That's absolutely fascinating. So you've talked about the Bank of Internet, and one of the things that people would note pretty quickly about your portfolio, you're not heavily weighted to the tech sector, in fact, quite the opposite. S&P 500, now 24% of earnings from the tech sector, so you're very much underweight in that area. Can you talk us through why that might be?
Look, I think I come from a value investing background, so it's been a little hard to get very excited about very expensive stocks on most conventional metrics.
Yes.
That's the first thing. Second thing is that it's not so we've never invested in that. We had a very substantial position in Samsung Electronics, which is definitely a tech stock. Our view is that we can't be expert at everything.
Right.
So we will look at tech, and there are aspects of tech that I do find interesting. But if I really can't understand what the company's doing, I'm not going to invest in it. I know it sounds like a very boring thing to say, but there are a lot of things in the world like global pharma, pharmaceuticals. I just really don't understand exactly what they're doing.
Yeah.
And if I can't do that, it's not fair to take that risk on behalf of our investors.
You need to, certainly Farmers a good example where you want to have someone with a very strong background in that area. From an analytics perspective, and you probably want several people with a very strong background in that sector.
Or at least have a top-down view. I mean, you know, a lot of that sector has not done very well because the ones that have proprietary drugs, like say, you know, a Merck or those guys tend to have what's called, they're constantly finding what's called the patent cliff, where their patents are running down, they've got to find new formulations to replace them. So you might short those if you think that's going to happen.
Yeah.
And similarly, on the generic side, it's become an absolute bloodbath. So one of the world's largest generic companies, Teva, is teetering on the edge of bankruptcy.
Right.
So, you know, again, it's not that we don't have any understanding, but we're just going to be very careful. We're not going to invest in a single company with a single application.
Right. Fantastic. So one of the things I think that's most interesting to our younger investors in particular is the ethical screens you apply. On a personal level, I find it fascinating how people apply their own ethical screens. My mother applies the ethical screen for my parents' portfolio, which I think is particularly amusing as a good illustration of how people apply negative screens. Not comfortable with gambling. Obviously not comfortable with armaments and a number of other things, but fine with alcohol because they both enjoy wine. So their screening is an interesting approach. You have your own approach. Talk us through it.
Well, the example you give is a very interesting one. So I'm the token, not token, but I'm the teetotaler in the group.
Ah, I see.
All of my colleagues drink. We don't invest in alcohol stocks. Now, it's a debate I had when I was at Hunter Hall, where we actually could invest in alcohol stocks, and but here we don't.
Right.
Why is that? Because we are running a portfolio for multiple people, and I think our view is I wrote a blog about this on our website after we launched our LIC to explain how we'd formed our ethical charter.
Yes.
And our view is, you can't please all the people all the time.
No, it's a really tricky area.
So our secondary view is, you've got to please most of the people all the time.
Yeah.
That's our view. So we know there's some people who say, well, why shouldn't I invest in alcohol stocks if I drink myself? My personal view is that most people drink responsibly, but enough people drink irresponsibly that is a social issue.
Yes.
That's why we don't invest in alcohol. We don't invest in companies involved in environmental destruction, which we include oil and gas, because we do think those things are unsustainable.
Yes.
And we do think it's a feedback, by the way, into the investment case.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, it's readily apparent that if the world is going to keep within the scope of warming that we think is not irreversible, then all the reserves that if you add up all the reserves on all the coal miners and oil and gas companies, they've got too much reserves in their balance sheet for us to stay within that limit.
Yes.
Therefore, they are inherently, as a sector, overvalued. So we think it's actually quite. There will be times when they go up and times when they go down. But if you take a long-term view, they are troubled businesses.
Yes.
Tobacco is a fascinating example.
Yeah.
Tobacco companies have very low capex. They're not allowed to spend any money on marketing anymore. The government's been very kind to them. They ban them advertising.
Yes.
Ka-ching, ka-ching for their profits.
Yes.
But the reality is, there's not much more governments can do to make their life good by banning advertising.
Yeah.
They're just going to raise taxes continuously.
Yes.
So that's not good for them, because at a certain point, people will actually be put off by the cost of smoking.
Yes. And have been for many years.
Yes.
Certainly in Australia.
But amazingly, we haven't reached the point yet where government revenues are going down by raising taxes. It's people are so addicted.
Still continuing.
But the other point about tobacco companies is they typically paid very high dividends.
Right.
Now, in a world where bond rates were falling, where interest rates were low, people really value that dividend stream.
Yeah, indeed.
If we're entering a world where interest rates are going up, the relative attraction of that dividend stream will go down.
Yes.
So we think those stocks are probably doomed for a bit of underperformance. The governments aren't going to be nice to them anymore. They're going to start being nastier by raising taxes. And the relative attraction of their dividend yield is going to go down.
Yeah, fantastic. So you also apply so those negative screens are fascinating. You also apply a positive screen, which I think is particularly interesting for people. So it's only 5%.
Well, it's minimum 5%.
Oh, sorry,
we're
minimum
well
5%.
Above that, actually.
Okay, beautiful. So where are you now?
It's about 10%.
Okay, fantastic.
So can I give you an example of some of those stocks?
So I was going to say, can you talk us through what you've got in there? Because I know our investors would love to hear about it.
Now, people who live in Sydney are probably not going to enjoy me saying this, but we are an investor in a company called Alstom. Mm. Now, the reason why I say is Alstom is one of the largest makers. They make trams and trains mm-hmm. around the world. It's a very focused business these days. Mm. And they're guys who are going to provide the trams that are going to operate on us, Sydney Light Rail, whenever it is finally finished. Mm. We think that mass transportation is a very good thing. Mm-hmm. We think it is actually, it makes most cities in the world nicer to live in.
Yes.
It also improves the environment. Mm. And so we're very excited about being involved in a company that is particularly strong at building rail, metro and tram networks in developing countries.
Okay, so primarily in developing countries.
Yeah, well, no, they do, but a lot of their growth is coming out of developing countries. Mm-hmm. So that's
the social benefit to that as much as everything else.
Exactly, that's a French-listed company, mm-hmm. but it's a global operates globally. It's about to merge with its major competitor in Europe, which is the rail arm of Siemens. Mm-hmm. So there'll be a European global champion, if you like. Mm-hmm. Very exciting company, not very expensive. And we think with a lot of very predictable growth, their order book is longer than it's ever been. They've got so much work they can't even do it.
Right.
Some other examples, again, a little bit more obscure than that. We own shares in a company called China Everbright, mm-hmm. China Everbright International, I should say, sorry, which is a waste-to-energy company operating in China, but also has operations in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. So what they're doing is they're solving a really big problem in densely populated developing countries, the growing waste stream, and they have I was literally cutting edge environmental treatment plants that burn that waste mm-hmm. to generate electricity. So they get paid by local authorities to take waste that was previously being dumped mm-hmm. in waste dumps, and then they get paid by the electricity grid to generate power.
That's quite powerful.
It is quite powerful. Mm. And then another company we own, a smaller position which we own in China, is a company called China Water Affairs Group, mm-hmm. which is there's a big problem in China in that the last mile delivery of drinkable water is very inefficient business, particularly in smaller cities. Mm-hmm. So these guys basically buy the poorly run, poorly maintained water distribution operations from struggling municipalities, mm-hmm. turn them around, the municipality keeps a 40% stake in that business,
right.
and they generate profits. So it goes from being a loss maker for the municipality to a profitable business.
Mm-hmm. And also providing
They deliver better water, but also they put meters into the system, which means that the water usage is more efficient, because China's got a problem with lack of water.
So all of those last two stocks, the Chinese stocks, where are they listed?
They're listed in Hong Kong.
Okay, fantastic. So you previously, as I was going to ask this question, you talk about Chinese-based stocks, but they're listed in Hong Kong. You have previously invested in some frontier markets, so you've invested in some areas that most investors have never held anything directly. How do you deal with some of the governance issues in those sorts of areas?
Well, it's a very good question. I mean, so probably the frontier market we've invested most in the past is Pakistan, mm-hmm. Which is, red lights going off everywhere. We don't have no stocks in Pakistan at the moment. Mm. But actually, it's a very interesting country. One of our mantras in terms of governance and social, for that matter, is to try and invest in things which are perhaps not great, but getting better. Okay. And our view on Pakistan, actually things are getting better, both at the government level and also at the corporate governance level. Mm-hmm. We've only owned three stocks in Pakistan. Mm-hmm. We managed to make money from all of them, which is nice.
Excellent.
We've owned two cement companies. Mm-hmm. The first one was a company called Lucky Cement, which was very lucky for us indeed. it's the biggest cement company in Pakistan. Mm. And that was a very good experience. We owned another cement company called DG Khan Cement. Mm-hmm. And then we owned a company that does it both makes electrical white goods, fridges and so on. It also makes switching gear for the grid. Mm-hmm. So they were all happy experiences. Mm. The governance, I would say the governance at Lucky and DG Khan is pretty good. Mm-hmm. The governance at the white goods company was, we were less confident about it, so it was a smaller position and we actually exited it much quicker.
Okay.
To be honest, you don't want to do that kind of stuff unless you're willing. This is another reason why I think we don't encourage people to do this from home. If not easy to buy those stocks, by the way. You have to use, have a what's called a prime broker to buy them.
Yeah, but, it would be quite challenging for the
other thing is I just think you, if the more funky the market, the more important is you guys should go and visit personally. Yeah. So we, you know, I visited Pakistan, which was a very enjoyable trip, fascinating. But I don't think it's something you want to do without investing, without going to visit them directly yourself.
Yeah, feeling close to it. Jack, any final thoughts for investors?
That's the great question.
Where can they go to?
We have a lot of thoughts. We do believe in sharing our thoughts. I would encourage your investors to go to our website because we do publish blogs virtually every week. Mm-hmm. And we also appear on Sky Business every Wednesday.
Yes.
I, one of my colleagues, has a chat with Helen Daly in the afternoon every Wednesday. So, and the other thing I would say is that we're a small firm. We have a we do focus on our transparency. So it is not going to bother me if somebody wants to call me up and have a chat.
Wow, that's wonderful. You're very generous with your thoughts on the market and different stocks, and I think people really appreciate that. It's very beneficial.
Well, as an ethical investor, one of our obligations is actually to have that transparency. One of the reasons why we believe it's important to have that transparency is that we are certified, our products are certified by the Responsible Investment Association of Australasia. Mm-hmm. We're also a signatory to the Principles of Responsible Investing, which is a formerly UN-backed organisation, which makes it a condition of your being a signatory to that, that you have transparency of what you do. Mm-hmm. And you can't really be transparent if you don't share with your investors what you're doing.
Yeah, what you're doing.
And we like to pride ourselves on making time to do that.
It's incredibly valuable, and I think people have really appreciated it today. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Your Wealth. We always love to hear from you, so if you have any feedback or suggestions for future topics, or if you'd like us to ask Jack anything in the future, please just email us at yourwealth@nab.com.au. I'm Gemma Dale. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for listening to Your Wealth with Gemma Dale. To stay up to date, please subscribe to this podcast series or email us at yourwealth@nab.com.au.
Please note that any advice provided in this podcast has been prepared without taking into account your objectives, financial circumstances, or needs. Before acting, you should consider the appropriateness of the information. To find out more, please visit nab.com.au.